I'm standing on top of a roof in Brooklyn, New York, on one of the most unlikely farms I've ever been to. It's 8 stories up, and it's just incredible. In the distance, I can see the Manhattan skyline. I can see the American flag fluttering in the breeze above my head. By my feet, I'm walking through some chard, some rocket, the most amazing peppers or capsicums that I've ever seen. They look so healthy. There's browns and reds and yellows. And I'm now walking over to some brassicas. There's kale and what looks like maybe Brussels sprouts or sprouting broccoli for later in the year. There's cabbages. And everywhere, the farmers that farm this have allowed wild areas to grow around the edges. And they planted plants that attract and feed birds and provide nectar and pollen for bees. I can see 2 sparrows feeding on some ripe sunflower heads, and there's a couple of doves pecking on the ground for some seeds. It's just incredible, the life up here. I'm just letting you listen to the sound of the city 8 stories down. So the farm is Brooklyn Grange at Sunset Park on 850 3rd Avenue, Brooklyn. It's one of a network of urban farms in New York City, in Brooklyn, Manhattan and Queens. This one is 3.2 acres of soil atop a large building. At its base is a shopping mall. New York is one of the world's most metropolitan cities, so it's a great location to talk about sustainable agriculture, food, fibre supply chains, and wider sustainable living. Brooklyn Grange's sister farm, Brooklyn Navy Yard, spans 1.5 acres, and together these sites produce a staggering 45 tons of food, which supports local communities, restaurants, and retail stores, all from a rooftop in a city. Brooklyn Grange is one of the best managed agricultural units I think I've ever seen in the many countries of the world that I've visited. These farms are also a feat of engineering to bear the weight of the soil that absorbs hundreds of thousands of gallons of rainfall annually, helping to prevent overload of New York's sewage network, as seen in the recent floods across the city. It's a massive issue for a city of this scale, where 70% of its land area is covered in tarmac. I was in New York for a summit at the United Nations headquarters to talk about sustainable farming, specifically cotton. So it seemed fitting to find out what sustainable food and farming means to New York's population of just under 9 million people, at a time when its mayor, Eric Adams, is looking to reduce the city's greenhouse gas emissions by 33%. Given that food accounts for 20% of New York's overall emissions, reducing waste and sourcing local are just some of the changes afoot. Urban agriculture has gained popularity globally as a way to grow and supply local food more sustainably within a town or city's boundaries. Metropolitan farms and gardens also give residents access to green space, a place to learn about growing food, and provide community spaces and support. Sunset Point's Brooklyn Grange Farm is a perfect place to see this in practice. I asked Brian Comrus, a farmer here, about why he chose to farm in the city.
I was an environmental studies major, and I chose that more so because I had an interest in food and cooking and more in the culinary arts, and figured there might be a wider range of career options in the food industry than I was exposed to. So I kind of focused in food systems and wasn't really sure, but I really had no exposure to agriculture or gardening. No one in my family was a gardener. So I think once I started getting a bit more exposure to other aspects of the supply chain and became more interested in agriculture. Yeah, my first farming job was also in Brooklyn. It was an indoor hydroponic farm, and it kind of got me hooked on production farming in particular, although not so much on the hydroponic side. It was a good kind of like first step into the industry. I've been working at Brooklyn Grange. This is my 5th season. This particular green roof is a production farm, 1 1/3 acre, so almost 1.5 acres. In peak summer, we're pulling about 2,000 pounds of food each week.
Wow.
But of course, that ranges from salad greens to tomatoes.
For the Brooklyn Grange team, their role extends to a community-supported agriculture scheme, or a CSA, education and supporting the local community by supplying fresh foods. I asked Yanni Fu Weng and Joan Huang, both Brooklyn Grange farmers, to tell me more about their other work.
Brooklyn Grange is the biggest rooftop farm in the world in a collective measure because we have different locations. So it's not just the one in Sunset Park, we also have like Levy Yard. So like collectively, I think the total acreage makes us the world's biggest.
Joan Huang talked about community partnerships. It was lovely to hear all the things that Brooklyn Grange is doing for the local ethnically diverse community.
We partner with a couple of organizations located in Sunset Park, one of them being a client choice food pantry called The Table. We send a lot of food to the table. The client choice model is super cool because it allows, you know, autonomy in selection of donated food, as opposed to just handing people a box indiscriminately and saying, this is what you get. We had been told by key stakeholders in the community that, you know, there are greater than average levels of food insecurity. So this is definitely an area where different kind of, I think we can really kind of explore and not so much experiment, but put into practice and gather real information and data about how food can be distributed more equitably and justly. There's definitely going to be systems and infrastructure in place wherein we can really, you know, effectively grow and move food to feed everybody. Like, that's, to me, like a non-negotiable, regardless of what's happening with the economy.
From the Brooklyn rooftop, the Manhattan skyline is clear and close. The United Nations headquarters sits on the East River between 42nd and 48th Street, where I attended a sustainable cotton workshop organized by BASF. Everywhere you are on the site, you see references to the UN's 17 Sustainable Development Goals. This context made it very fitting to have cotton as our focus. Global cotton production is estimated at 25 million tons of production, over 70% of which is produced in China, India, and the USA, as well as Brazil. Cotton is a vital crop for the world, providing an income for more than 250 million people and accounting for half of all society's textiles. The demand for sustainable cotton is escalating. Here's Ray Daniels.
So I'm the sustainability manager for North America for BASF's Agricultural Solutions seeds business. And I want to welcome each of you to this really historic and important event. First off, I want to ask a couple questions. So why are we here today? That's the main thing. Why is BASF here? One, BASF Agricultural Solutions, we are committed to creating chemistry for a more sustainable future. We're committed to continue to advance the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And part of that is through our agricultural unit where we develop solutions to create a more sustainable outcome for farmers, but also programs and tools to help farmers do the biggest job on earth, which is raising cotton and growing cotton sustainably. And why are our farmers here today? Well, there's no greater person on the forefront of the climate crisis to help address this challenge than our farmers. Farmers have the tools and the ability in their hands to do an amazing array of things, and there are many things that they are doing today that we hope that you can learn about when it comes to sustainability. When it comes to growing cotton sustainably and sourcing sustainable fibers, there's so much that goes into that crop each and every year, a lot of sweat, a lot of love, and a lot of hardship that makes that cotton the way it is. And a lot of our farmers incorporate practices into their farms that are environmentally and economically sustainable, but also at the same time contributing to their communities and the empowerment of each other. So I will say, why are we here at the United Nations headquarters? Not just because it's a fantastic location. You can see the Chrysler Building outdoors. We're here because it's the 78th session of the General Assembly, and this General Assembly is focused on the advancement of the Sustainable Development Goals. And so we're here in New York during what is, for farmers, the busiest time of year for harvest. We're also here in New York for that reason, because of the UN, because of the Sustainable Development Goals. And I like to say there's no better place than right here and right now for this conversation to take place. Our goal, like I said, for you to walk out of here with one thing, is understanding the real story behind what goes into sustainably grown and raised cotton.
I spoke to Sledge Taylor, and the first thing I asked him was, what does sustainable farming mean to him? He farms near Como in Mississippi.
Sustainable means, you know, providing for the future. When my father took over the farm, a lot of the land had been eroded, it had been abused, and it just, people didn't understand good farming principles. So sustainability to me is providing for the future, yet managing to take care of our needs today. We do a lot of no-till, in fact, almost entirely all no-till cotton, which means just not tilling the soil. And then I plant cover crops in addition to that. And so we're planting into fields that have not been tilled, but also have a cover crop that grew during the winter. And so it looks like this blanket of crop material on the land that just helps insulate the ground. It helps soak up rainfall. And it's been very, very successful for us.
In the depths of the UN building, Sledge and I spoke about the importance of communication, what it meant for him to be at the UN and having the conversations that we had.
I don't think people understand how much farming has changed in the last 20 years. And so I think one thing that I've messaged to get out is to showcase and tell people exactly what we are doing. And there are a lot of farmers that are doing sustainable farming, and we're growing and learning every year. And so here, I hope to network with other farmers about what they're doing, talk to people here at the United Nations about sustainability, and it's just always a learning curve when you meet and talk to people.
Sledge has had a deep involvement in the National Cotton Council of the United States. It's an important representative body for the whole of the cotton supply chain.
The National Cotton Council is more of the political arm of the cotton business in the United States. It's comprised of seven segments that cover everything to do with cotton. We have merchants, we have mills, we have warehouses, cotton ginners, cotton farmers, etc. And we all agree on a policy. It's very unique in that what policy we go ahead with, we have all agreed upon. So it's very powerful in the fact that we're not segmented. But it's also a very, very effective organization within Washington, D.C. as far as farm policy, et cetera, but also looks after the farmers' interest in things that may come up in other countries that might be detrimental to the United States.
Sledge told me how important cotton is to the U.S. and its wider economy.
Well, cotton's extremely important in the United States. I forget the actual contribution to the economy. A lot of it stays local. You know, you pick your own cotton on the farm, but then we have a cotton gin that processes the cotton, and that provides jobs. And then the cotton seed then again provide jobs within another industry. It just doesn't start with the cotton in the field. It goes down through a number of, it provides money for the warehouses, it provides money for the mills, the merchants, the retailers. And so it's a very strong segment of our economy.
The reason the farmers were gathered at the UN was because of their involvement in BASF's end-to-end sustainable cotton supply chain, Certified Sustainable Fibermax, or E3, as it is called in the US. The chain is underpinned by blockchain, building trust about the sustainability practices growers through to garment retailers are subscribing to make cotton greener in its footprint. Sledge explained why being involved mattered to him.
Quite often farmers are asked to do things that maybe benefit society or benefit other aspects of the economy, and we are not rewarded for it. And so the E3 program, at least, is rewarding us for some of the work we do. So I'm very supportive of that. Quite the sustainability of cotton is somewhat driven by the consumer, which then goes to the retailer, who then comes down the chain to the farmer. And the National Cotton Council recognized the importance of it. I think in 2015, they started what they call the Cotton Trust Protocol, formally operational now. And it's the place where farmers can go and showcase what they're doing. Independent research can come and look on the cotton farm to verify what we're doing to showcase the sustainability that we are doing.
Richard Guana farms with his family in Fisher County in Texas. He too grows CSF cotton.
Yes, I'm from what we call West Texas, that's the rolling plains of Texas, mostly I'm a dry land farmer. We've got very little irrigation. I also have cattle and also grow wheat and sorghum Sudan for hay and grass also.
And Richard, you're involved with BASF. yes. through the E3 program.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what that means to you and to your business.
When they started, I've been a FiberMax Stoneville producer for many, many years. That's all I plant. Their varieties. They've got a very good quality product. When they started the E3 program, I was one of the first ones to, you know, in our area to implement that. And to me, it's very important to. That's the only way that we can put our message out there and show them what we're trying to do in farming. We are trying to take care of our land, and if we can put it on there and then they show other people what we're doing, that's why I'm supportive of it. I see the good things, because as farmers, we're not used to talking about ourselves, but these programs do help. And getting involved in other programs like the U.S. Cotton Protocol also is another one. I mean, but getting involved and telling our story. And that's one of the good reasons I'm in E3. So it does tell our story.
And part of E3 is having blockchain embedded in it, mm-hmm. which builds trust and it communicates provenance.
Right.
How do you think that will help in further understanding what you as a grower have to do?
It helped because they could trace where it came from. I mean, that's the whole thing. You've got to know where people want to know where it came from and how it was grown, and there's nothing wrong with that. I fully agree with that. And the E3 program works, and the other products. I mean, there's other programs out there too. But the thing is that the main thing is in the United States we grow the best cotton that there is, best quality cotton, and we've got to put that message out because most of our cotton is exported. 85% of our cotton goes out of country, and when they lay down those bales, that's when you don't know what cotton, where that cotton's come to. Once they take that wrapping off, but you can trace it all the way to there. But now we can trace it even farther, although you know, in the fabric and things like that, and that makes a difference to show that what we're doing and that we're growing a great quality of cotton.
The CSF program extends through the length of the cotton supply chain, so I asked a ginner, a process that removes harvested cotton from the husk, what sustainability means. Emanuela Karoudi is a third generation cotton ginner from Greece. Here's what she said.
You know, there is a big supply chain, and sustainability may mean totally different things for each part of the supply chain. I mean, for the farmers, it has more to do with the practices, water usage, soil health, working condition, better income. It's difficult to give a specific definition because there are 80 cotton-growing countries in the world. City by city, country by country, we can see many differences due to the legislations. As for the farmers, it has to do more with the practices. For the ginners, it has to do with the process, like we have to take care of the farmers we used to collaborate with. We have to set some specific goals. We have to ask for sustainability from them. And we have to make a space in the cotton industry and in the market for this sustainable cotton to be sold. And then for the final consumers, it has to do with the story behind the cloth. It has to do with the transparency. To know where this cloth was made, from who, what criteria, and which cotton. So there are a lot of different definitions for everybody, but in the end of the day, there are the three main pillars that have to be understood by everybody. The society, the environment, and the financial aspect. Because of the Europe legislations, it became very popular. So it's the main cultivation in Greece right now. We used to export almost the whole quantities, Greece, mm-hmm. and in Europe it's only Greece and Spain that produce cotton, mm-hmm. with Greece being the leader, so it's really important for us. We are proud to say that we help in continuing this journey, and you can see a lot of new generations of farmers, like the farmers that are here with us today. It's most of them are second or third generation of cotton farmers, and they're still really in love with this job. So yeah, we're very happy. Most of the cotton that is already grown in Greece is more or less sustainable, because for sure we don't use kids in the farms or take good care of the environment. I think the most things that have to change has to do with the transparency during the whole process, to prove that we're doing things sustainably using technology, blockchain or whatever, and also to educate the final consumers and the brands, because it's a high trend to claim that you are sustainable. But in the end of the day, you have to be ready to prove it one way or another. And that has to do with the industry, like the ginning mills, the spinning mills, but also with the final consumers, starting asking where their maids are coming from.
Conscious production is all well and good, but if I, as a consumer, choose to buy a cheap t-shirt with no known provenance nor environmental credentials, then I may be unwittingly funding unsustainable fashion. To find out more about what's happening at the retail end of the cotton chain, I quizzed Bob Antoshak, a seasoned commentator and consultant in the textile industry. Bob talks about dirt to shirt, so the whole of the cotton supply chain, and some of the challenges therein.
With the advent of particularly fast fashion and overconsumption and constantly cutting prices and encouraging overconsumption and building up, you know, a business model around overconsumption, I think it finally came back to haunt a lot of the companies that were responsible for that. Yeah, they made a lot of money and they figured out a new model, but along the way, they helped wreck the planet. I think that realization was also brought about by their customers. Their customers were concerned. And increasingly, they came to realize that sustainability has to be real and it can't just be empty marketing. I think at the beginning, a lot of companies tried the marketing approach. Oh, we'll go ahead and we'll hit this, sustainability goal in, the year 2080, kind of target. But a lot of people have seen through all that. And so now's the time for action. And many companies now are trying to figure out how to clean up their supply chains. And again, I think there's also been a realization that if they handle sustainability properly, it's actually an efficiency program and it cuts costs. And everyone's always into that, of course. There's a curiosity of where things are made. And it isn't so much that every consumer comes in and says, well, I want to know if it's sustainably made. I think the first question that many consumers ask is, where's it made? How's it made? And along with that comes a story of how it was made and then whether it was made under what conditions. And again, this is where you get in this gray area with marketing and true sustainable initiatives. And that's up for the consumers, I think, help to drive that. I also think, too, there's an acknowledgement on the part of governments around the world that they have to take a more active role in encouraging the kind of sustainable initiatives. So it kind of comes together. Having said all that, there's always a group of consumers, price, that's all they care about. And you have to be realistic about that. The sustainability would be one of the last things they would really think about. But at the end of the day, there's definitely enough of affluent consumer base that is looking to understand how things were made, why things were made the way they were. And they often will ask the question, if Canopy, can you document, as you show us how it was made and where things came from, can you document sustainable practices in manufacturing, growing, and so forth?
Bob gave his views on BASF's CSF or E3 program.
I think E3 has demonstrated itself over the years as being a significant change agent for cotton. It's very gratifying to see the cotton industry now getting behind various initiatives, industry-wide initiatives, that 20 years ago just never would have come up. Whereas now they're really important, they're well-run, well-managed, and effective, and particularly in the case of the farm community.
For a city like New York, there's a growing consciousness about reducing waste, both food and packaging. Given that the US discards more food than any other country in the world, some 60 million tons annually, which equates to 40% of the entire US food supply, it's understandable that citizens want to take action. To understand what this means to people living in the city, I joined Krikor Daglian for a tour around his home neighborhood of East Village in Manhattan. He explained the origins of the district.
This whole neighborhood, or most of it, and a little area north of here, was once farmland back in the 1600s and 1700s. Of course, prior to that, it was just forests and woods and streams. And then once the Dutch came in, they started to place farms here and there. This is actually the farmland of the Stuyvesants. The Stuyvesants were a very important family here in New Amsterdam and then New York, because Peter Stuyvesant came in when it was still a Dutch colony, basically was the one who made it a viable colony, really made it very profitable and organized. Eventually, though, the English came and took over, and he was allowed to keep some land up here, and it stayed in the family for decades and decades. So the area near St. Mark's Church in the Bowery, which was originally the site of their family chapel, there's a road that goes kind of through there called Stuyvesant Street. That was originally a road that led from the farm road up from the colony in the city up to the farms up here. The Dutch word for farm was boerderij, got changed to Bowery. We still have the Bowery to this day. And then they had a little road, which we now call Stuyvesant Street, which went between the two Boweries, Bowery number one and number two, which were the Stuyvesant's farm.
On our tour, Krikor described the food and culture of East Village and wider New York City's increased focus on sustainability.
The foods we're going to have today are a combination of different eras. You have the immigrant era, when people came here from many different countries and brought their food culture and occupied the neighborhood for a time. And of course, they opened these restaurants to cater to people that came there from their country. But some of these restaurants became popular with others and have lasted beyond the time when it was the neighborhood for that ethnicity. We also have a period in the 1950s and 60s when artists, writers, visual artists, musicians, bohemians, people who didn't fit in to mainstream culture came here and created art here in this neighborhood. And of course, they didn't have much money, so they went to street food and diners and also newer food ideas of the time, whether it was vegetarian restaurants or South Asian food or East Asian food that came in the 70s and 80s. And in the last 25 years or so, it's really been a neighborhood where chefs, entrepreneurs, people who want to start their own restaurant or food business have found their way here, because there's a lot of small storefronts, a lot of people going out to eat. We have a lot of colleges around here. A lot of people move here in their 20s and 30s and work long hours and want to go out, aren't cooking at home. So you have all these factors that make it a very vibrant food neighborhood. And so between all that, we have over 400 places to get food around here.
At the start of this podcast, I outlined what New York's mayor is doing to improve the sustainability of this vast city, how it deals with food waste, recycling, and growing the city's own food systems.
Just in any kind of city, there's always going to be a large scale of everything, and there's a lot of food waste here. I know that the city is trying to cut down on that. The figures vary somewhere between 37%, which is the Department of Sanitation's number, and the Independent Budget Office says about 50% of our waste is stuff that could be diverted from going to a landfill. So, you know, a lot of this is either recycling or food waste. And so there's been efforts to try to remedy that by having, now they're introducing mandatory composting over the next couple of years. Unfortunately, they don't really have large sites for actually turning it into fertilizer. So it's mostly being used to catch the gases that come off methane and use it for energy. Even at this point, there's, I think, something like 20,000 homes being supplied by that, but it's still a small scale effort. They've been talking about doing composting now for many years, and it's finally happening in a mandatory way. And this neighborhood actually was a neighborhood that had community gardens, which were basically empty city land that was not being used back in the 70s and 80s. And these little gardens were developed by locals to reclaim the space. And many of those have had composting efforts for a long time. They started having these green markets a few decades ago, and we have some pretty famous ones in Union Square. We have a big market multiple times a week where you have probably 100 different vendors coming in selling vegetables, selling baked goods, selling cider, and all kinds of different things from the surrounding area. And often these purveyors are quite valued by the restaurants, because many restaurants go there to get certain things that are hard to find. They're not only there for residents, but also for businesses. I think New Yorkers generally have been pretty good about trying to recycle, at least from their home. The big problem, of course, is people's awareness of which plastics can actually be recycled. I think people will do it if they feel like the efforts are going to pay off. And so I think hopefully the city can develop the composting program more and the recycling program more, which motivates people if they feel like it's really making a difference. Because if you find out it doesn't really make a difference, then you'll just throw it in the trash.
Alongside food waste, discarded packaging contributes a huge environmental burden to the world. OECD says that only 9% of plastic waste is recycled globally. When you consider that each person in the US alone generates 221 kilograms of plastic waste annually, that's a colossal volume of reusable material that's being lost. Stora Enso is a Finnish manufacturing company. They produce packaging, construction, and other materials from wood fibre, all sourced from sustainably managed forests. Their business is wholly circular. I spoke to Philip Hannefeld.
We are, of course, positioned in this packaging part of it, which is, you know, after production when the food is already done. And here our focus is specifically around, first of all, reducing food waste. Because if you're wasting food, that's probably the worst thing you can do with the food. And still a quarter is wasted, or even a little bit more depending on region. And that is maybe the primary focus, of course, of our job, to make packaging better and to reduce that food waste. And then you can also, of course, look at these secondary effects. Where does the packaging end? Does it pollute? Does it create enough circularity and so on? So that's maybe the big picture of where we are fitting in and what we are working with. Example here, we have invested in a plant in Poland now, which takes back these milk cartons that you are, you know, very familiar with probably every morning when you're pouring the milk. And or a milk substitute. I mean, there's a lot of plant-based coming now, which is also important in the food transition. And taking those back and recycling the whole bit, including this aluminium foil that's still in there and the plastic part. And then, of course, the majority is the fiber. So we are working with this and actually establishing recycling infrastructure to make sure we get the material back into the loop. And then in the regions where this is not so much pronounced, I think other end-of-life solutions are more prone, such as compostability. So making sure that you can actually avoid, first of all, litter and something that is then going into the environment maybe unnecessarily is not creating a long-term problem, at least what goes away. And then if you are collecting it back, then you can actually, you know, still make something useful out of it. You can either make soil out of it, or you can get biogas back or something like this. So depending on the system that you are looking at. And there we are developing options as well. And then, of course, long shot would be some solutions that are doing the job very well, but maybe in the end, they are even eatable. I mean, you all know the iconic ice cream cone that is actually eatable. So along that line, maybe also more of that going forward. Yeah.
Well, that's absolutely fascinating. And Philip, you mentioned milk cartons. What other packaging do you produce within your business?
Other than milk carton, we are also, for example, we are the leader in Europe for all kinds of food service products that are made out of fibers. Typically in fast food restaurants, what you would get is these, you know, burger clamshells and these little inserts for the fries and so on. So all of that is something we produce. And we also, of course, are in constant discussion there, how much of this could actually be done with the reusable systems. I mean, that's a big discussion in legislation now. So what is better, reuse or recycling? And there, my answer would be depends, actually, because there's a lot of studies around both topics. And if you have a fairly good way to hygienize it, so if you have enough space, maybe locally, or if you can bring it to a hub and wash it properly, yes, then absolutely reuse is a good idea. If you need to, if you, you know, need to take shortcuts there, or maybe your transportation ways get too long and you lose product because it leaves your premises, so people take, you know, drive through and then they don't bring it back but throw it in the trash, then recycling is better. Because in reuse, you have very big amounts of material that you need. So the cups are very sturdy. You need a lot of plastic actually to make them. And if people are throwing them away, then this is extremely bad. So I think it depends on the system and the circumstances. But that's also a growing trend. This convenience food, on-the-go food, and maybe pre-made meals, especially in Global North, is something that is on the rise. And for good reasons, because people are, you know, busy and maybe more on the road. But then nutrition needs to be protected. It needs to be higher in nutrition and value, lower in preservatives to be more healthy. And then packaging needs to be better. So it's all linked.
Yeah. And then taking it one step forward, you know, right at the very beginning of our conversation, you talked about your ownership of forest. You really are a circular business, end to end and back again. So completely circular. Just talk me through what that word circularity and also, I suppose, sustainability means to you as a business.
Yeah, it's pretty much in the heart of what we do. I mean, if you look at the raw material, it is growing back, but it needs to be also sustainably managed and harvested. I mean, there's a lot of, I would say, bad practices out in the world where forestry is is done in an erosive way, and we are basically owning the most of the land we use, and we are managing it in a sustainable way. We are actually now looking at biodiversity factors. So biodiversity loss is the biggest topic, of course, for forestry, and we are also actually publishing on our website. We are publishing these indicators that we have discussed together with NGOs and universities to measure the health of the forest and the state of our harvesting sites. And one topic, for example, is decaying wood. You have to leave wood in the forest that can decay, and then you have all the bugs and microbes and woodpeckers and everybody else in using it as an example. And then we are also looking at how many running waters we have in our forest. So we are mapping it and discussing then what is needed to make sure biodiversity is actually now improving. So if you're looking at some of the indicators, then biodiversity is actually on its way back in our managed forests. And that is extremely important as one of the values and discussion topics. And then at the same time, we also look very much into reducing CO2 emissions on the way when we are producing these materials based on forest growth and then it going through all the different value chain steps that we have, from grinding it down and then actually making a board, so a sturdy, rigid board that would actually then end up in a milk carton again. We want to be low in the CO2 emissions as possible within 2030. We have signed this science-based target initiative to reduce by 50%, and then actually overall with our actions as a company, we aim to be net positive even. So basically, if you take the whole balance of what the product does in the end and how much CO2 we invest in making it, then the balance should be positive. So if you, in the end, if you buy a product of this kind, you should actually sequester more carbon than it has released in its lifetime. That's the ambition.
Sustainability is a huge topic and one that we will revisit time and again in this podcast series. Coming up in the next episode, we'll be exploring the world of weeds, what makes a plant a weed, what makes it edible, and controlling troublesome weeds. Until then, thank you for listening to this episode with me, Jane Craigie. This podcast was produced by me and my team. Please make sure that you sign up to more episodes from this series wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.